Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Few political figures have captured the public's imagination more than John F. Kennedy. The nation's 35th president was young, handsome, a war hero with a beautiful wife who led the country briefly through a time of monumental challenge and change. Here he is on Inauguration Day, January 20th, 1960.
The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
An assassin's bullet, of course, cut John F. Kennedy down in his prime, leaving all kinds of questions behind. What kind of a president was he really? How did he change the country? And how might he have changed it further had he lived longer?
Over the past two decades, questions like these have inspired a number of biographies of JFK. And now comes the latest from Chris Matthews, who asks a most basic question. What was Jack Kennedy like? What made him tick?
Chris Matthews is host of MSNBC's Hardball and NBC's The Chris Matthews Show. His new book, Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero, draws on archival material, but also on plenty of original interviews with JFK's friends and advisors, including the late former House Speaker Tip O'Neill, for whom Chris Matthews worked. And Chris Matthews joins us right now from member station WAMU in Washington. And great to have you on Radio Boston, Chris Matthews. Thanks for coming on.
Good afternoon, Anthony and Ann. Here I am.
Well, it's good to have you. So let me talk to you first about your fascination with JFK. In your book, you talk about the fact that when you were young, you were a Republican, a supporter of Barry Goldwater. But even then, you write that you found JFK the most interesting political figure of the day. Why?
It's just one of those words that gets to the heart of your brain soup. Who are you interested in? I guess there's three people I sort of track automatically, instinctively, Winston Churchill, Jack Kennedy, and Ernest Hemingway. I just want to know more. I always want to know who they were, what they were, what they were like. What was it like to be with them? I think it's what Jack Kennedy said to Ben Bradley, the newspaper man, is the reason all of us read biography.
Well,
the him and him, not the political man and him, but the him. The guy who would be sitting next to you and you could feel his presence. The guy out in the South Pacific in the middle of the night when you're all sweating and there's nothing going on except the company you're keeping. And that guy, that's who I went for in the book.
Yeah, and you start off by this very simple idea. What was he like? I mean, what's the simple? That's a simple question. I know the answer obviously spawns 400 pages of writing. And by the way, Chris, it's a great book.
Thank you.
I had the last 3 or 4 days off, and I just had a ball of a time with it. It was really, really wonderful. But what was he like? I mean, what sort of jumps out, first of all?
Well, the best one, it was a guy named Dick Kersey. He's a fellow naval officer in the South Pacific over in the Solomons. And I assume the way he wrote the sort of the account, he was a Republican because he said, I don't want to talk about Kennedy's politics. A lot of those guys in the South Pacific obviously were naval officers, were Republicans in their politics. Like Red Fay was a good buddy of Jack's, but very much a Republican. He said, I can't talk about his politics, but I can say he was a good PT boat captain and he was great company. And he said, if those who don't think good company is important, imagine being out there in the middle of the night when it's sweating and hot and you're on some island that nobody will ever go back to and there's no showers, there's no movies for a diversion. It's just you in conversation. And he talked about Kennedy being a guy that could listen, who could laugh, who could enjoy your company, and he could give you a good story. I mean, it's just that basic thing of good company, and that's what I wanted to find. Someone once said of Winston Churchill that they sat in, I guess, in a drawing room situation late at night drinking, probably smoking cigars, and he said the later it turned past midnight, the more the man with me became Winston Churchill. And boy, that's what I'm after, and that's what I went after in this book all the way back to his years in prep school at Choate and the classmates' comments about him, his close friend Len Billings, what he said about him. That's what I was after.
The sense that I get from Jack Kennedy in reading your book is this guy with this insatiable intellectual curiosity. I mean, and it was demonstrated early on in his life, wasn't it?
Well, reading the story of a kid who's 14 years old and very sick all the time with unknown diseases, that was the part that really captured him. He never knew what they were talking about. The doctors kept saying, he's got an interesting case here. And Jack would laugh ironically and say, well, it'd be interesting to me if it wasn't me. Hmm. And they thought it was leukemia, and he was always getting his blood count checked. In fact, that was the only contact he had with his mother, who was so distant that she would call up, I guess, and they'd talk about his latest blood count. But he had read The History of World War I, The World Crisis by Winston Churchill, who, of course, was first Lord of the Admiralty in World War I. And he'd read that at the age of 14. He was reading The New York Times. I guess he got it by mail. That's all I can figure. They didn't have distribution in those days like this.
Right.
It wasn't the national newspapers we know back then. And he was getting it up in Connecticut, and he would read it every day. And Rip Horton, one of his roommates, said he would lie on his bed and sort of try to distill what he learned in the article as an exercise, not just read it like we read newspapers, but lie and think, now, what did I learn from that piece today from Arthur Kroc? What did I learn from that? And then he'd try to feed it back. I mean, he was trying to teach himself to be something. I'm not sure an electoral politician, but a guy who was really focused on, a kid who was very focused on politics.
Hmm. You write that a half a century of political life later, referring to yourself, my fascination with the elusive spirit of JFK has remained an abiding one. He is both a pathfinder and puzzle, a beacon and a conundrum. I'm really interested in that, and this gets to the subtitle of the book. In what way was he elusive?
Jacqueline Kennedy used that word. She said in a letter to Ted Sorensen about 85, she had just heard Sorensen's speech at the unveiling of Jack Kennedy's portrait at the National Portrait Gallery, where he talked about him being a guy who did good things and met his responsibilities to society and to his country, but also enjoyed life and enjoyed what he did doing. In other words, he had fun and pleasure. And she said, you've got him. You've figured out my Jack. And you've figured out that unforgettable, elusive man. And to her, he was elusive because he lived life, and it's all through the book, in compartments. There was one compartment for her, and they had a marriage, and they shared the emotions of his life. You can tell that in the tapes that just came out. And he also had these other women relationships, which are sometimes trivial and sometimes real. He had real romances throughout his life with different women. And then he had the Irish Mafia, who were his political confederates. He had a great time with them. They were tough guys, and guys like Kenny O'Donnell, and I got his tapes, his oral history tapes with Sandy Van Oker from NBC, 64 oral tapes I was able to get that no one else has
and
had.
And Kenny O'Donnell, of course, his advisor from the early days, right, when he ran for Congress in Massachusetts.
From 52 on, and it really made Jack as a political expert. He was really his counselor, and he's a tough guy, too. He was a tough black Irishman, really a tough, you know, not a hater, but a guy who kept an eye on the opponents, that's for sure. And anyway, Jack was living in these compartments, almost like the Titanic. Everything was a sealed-off compartment. The Irish Mafia were in one place, and they weren't really a mafia for the young people watching. They were just, that was a nickname for the pilot. I've been to a couple of audiences where young people have stood up and said, well, tell me about this mafia. And I said, no, it's
they were a gang of wise guys, basically.
Yeah.
Well, I can't use that word either.
Not those wise guys, no, but right. They were political hotshots, hardballers, if you will.
Right.
And backroom guys. And then, you know, and then he had he only hung out with people of old money. He only seemed to be comfortable with people like himself who hadn't really earned their way financially. He liked guys like David Ormsby Gore and Charlie Bartlett, who was a sixth-generation Yalie, and Chuck Spalding, who was an old Ivy League family. And he seemed to like their company. He wasn't comfortable with self-made men. The only one he hung out with that was sort of self-made was Torby McDonald, who later became a congressman up there in Massachusetts, and then Red Fay, who was sort of the son of a construction company owner, who wasn't exactly aristocratic, but generally, he was comfortable with old money. He was kind of an aristocratic Brit in a way. He was not only Anglophilic, he also liked the company of comfortable money. He did like that.
You just used that term, self-made guys, and he didn't like to hang out with them. But, you know, as I read your book, and I think you actually raised this point, but I certainly absorbed it if you didn't say it explicitly. You know, he is the son of privilege. Obviously, Joe Kennedy had tons and tons of money. It was always behind him in many ways. But in many ways, he was self-made. I mean, that's sort of one of the
points. He was a Gatsby. He was a guy who, although he was his father's son when it came to women, and I do not mean that as a courtesy or as a positive statement about him, he did have the attitude towards women, his father. Mm. And it wasn't a good attitude. And it's not only by contemporary standards, but by any standards. He just didn't respect women in the way you're supposed to on this planet. And number two, but he really was his own man in terms of his own person, in terms of he really opposed the old man on his anti-Semitism, his terribly chauvinistic view about America and money. He didn't. The old man was not a worldly guy. He didn't a global. Jack wanted to. He supported the Marshall Plan enthusiastically. The old man wanted Western Europe to fall to the Soviets, to Stalin, because it would be good for American business. I mean, the old man just didn't. He was like a Daddy Warbucks character. He wasn't a good guy by today's standards. And Jack kept thinking positively. There was a wonderful point at when he was attacked by Jack Javits and some in the Jewish community because of the old man's attitudes about the war and the comments he'd made, the anti-Semitic remarks he'd made. And Jack, after that campaign where he didn't do extraordinarily well in the Jewish community up in Massachusetts, Kenny O'Donnell had written a letter to a leader in the community, sort of one of these half-handed things where you don't really thank the guy. He said, it's too bad we didn't do so well, blah, blah, blah. And Kennedy saw the letter and said, well, let's think about the future here. And number two, Kenny, these people have problems you'll never understand. Well, that's empathy. Mm-hmm. And at that period of time coming out of the war when anti-Semitism was just beginning to pass out of acceptance in society and better circles. And Jack was ahead of his time. He was just a good guy. I have not found in all the reading of him any ethnic prejudice. Sure, he was an Irish guy in that sense, and he was proud of that, and he was defiant, but no negativity. And he was, in that sense, very much like Tip O'Neill, who I worked for all those years. I was in the back room with Tip, God, 6 years in a row, just sitting in the back room through all the heat of the Reagan administration. We were fighting a war every day, and he was in bad mood some days, I guess. He never, ever said anything that was wrong about people.
Interesting.
Ever. And for his generation to be that positive, it was just a statement of a true liberal, a good liberal.
Listeners, we're talking to Chris Matthews. He's the host of MSNBC's Hardball. He's also the author of Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. We want you to join the conversation. Who was JFK to you? What questions do you have for Chris Matthews about his book, about JFK? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Chris Matthews, you mentioned Tip O'Neill, for whom you worked, and I'm really interested in what his response was to Jack Kennedy when Jack Kennedy came on the scene, because in many ways they came from such different worlds. What did he tell you?
I wouldn't say that the speaker understood immediately the appeal of Jack Kennedy any more than he understood the appeal of Ronald Reagan initially. He saw Jack as a rich kid, a skinny, he used to say skinny, pasty face, because he came out of the war in such terrible shape. Not only had he had malaria, that was what he admitted, he also had the beginnings, I guess, of Addison's disease. He had a terrible congenitally injured back that was just injured from the time he was born, and one leg was shorter than the other, and he never recovered from the butchery of those operations he had in 1944. And he used to change colors every day. He had strange complexions. He would always, of course, covered up with a tan, but he did not look healthy. And also, Tip was an old-school guy who had worked his way up through the vineyards, he always said. Work your way up through the vineyards, through the chairs. And you can't run for Congress till you've run for the great and general court. You had to serve in the assembly first and then maybe state senator and then worked your way up. And here's Jack coming back from the war, almost like in a khaki election, coming right from uniforms into running. The only guy with a war record. People tell me he would have won that race even without the money because he was handsome and he was very much like a young Lindbergh. He looked like that American hero.
And he was a genuine war hero, right?
I mean, he was for real. I mean, he wasn't some guy that was captured or had a tough time. He was a guy that stuck his neck out. His crew was drowning in that ocean in the South Pacific when that PT boat of his was cut in half. And he went out and swam through the gasoline-burning water. And he was the one that saved a couple guys who were way off in the boat, the part of the boat that had sank. And he carried them back. And then the next day, he got the guys who couldn't swim together with the guys who could swim. Four guys couldn't swim, five could. He put them on an 8-foot plank together and ordered them to stick together. They were 4 miles from shore, 4 miles in the high seas. And he had one guy, Pappy McMahon, who was badly burned. His engineer, he's 42 years old. He was older than the other guys. Jack threw him on his back, his badly hurt back, pulled out a knife and cut the guy's strap of his life jacket, put the strap in his teeth, and towed the guy by his teeth for 4 miles, 4 miles of water. I mean, he had to really swim pulling that guy. And the guy had no idea how bad a shape Jack was in. He never complained about this, never bragged about it. he was a great World War II kind of guy. Never complained, never explained. There was a lot about him. He was a real hero. You're right. You're right, Anthony. He was the real thing.
And let me ask you about that first when he dives into Massachusetts, the sort of Massachusetts political scene when he's first running for Congress. Tell us about what he was up against. At one point, you described some pretty tough bare knuckle fighting that he had to do to engage to go up against the old entrenched Democratic Party machinery in Massachusetts.
Well, they were used to voting for their own kind. They all knew each other. It was highly ethnic, as you might imagine. There was an Irish candidate or two. There was an Italian candidate. Usually the Irish tended to be pretty tough about voting for their own. The Italians got used to voting for Irishmen and not getting much in return. There's a fellow named Joe Russo that ran. It was pretty tough. They would accuse him of being from Miami. They said he was basically a carpetbagger. And to a large extent, Jack, in his memoirs, which he began to dictate around 1960, he admitted as much. He said, my only real geographic claim to that area, the 11th District, which later became the 8th District, was I went to Harvard. And he has a wonderful way, a wry way of saying, that wasn't exactly a plus. Working guys, the townies, if you will, the regular people who lived up there, like Tip, saw Harvard as the elite. I mean, Tip O'Neill's a good example of a townie, and I mean it positively. He would cut grass on the lawn at Harvard, and he was there, and the overseer was almost like Simon Legree would come around and hit him on the back and say, on your knees, O'Neill. You know, you have to cut on your knees. You couldn't sit down while you're doing it. So here he is with shears cutting grass. And Tip gave this image, it's probably apocryphal, of during a prohibition that all the swells, I guess he'd call them, parents of the graduates were all drinking champagne on the lawn at Harvard at the Harvard Yard. And these working class kids from the neighborhood were shearing the lawn. You know, it doesn't exactly breed community spirit there. So Jack was on the wrong end of that feeling, and he knew it. He had that wonderful line when they were all at this candidates' night at this little community center. I forget where it was, and everybody was talking about how they'd worked their way up the hard way. And Jack came up and he said, "I guess I'm the only one here that didn't come up the hard way."
So he was honest.
It was funny, but it was what Bobby used to call it. Bobby Kennedy called that hanging a lantern on your problem. If you got a problem, hang a lantern on it so you're the first one to advertise it. I always tell people that is not bad advice about life. If you have a handicap or something, put people at ease and say, you know, yeah, I know it. I lost a leg in the war. And let them know what the problem was so they don't feel uncomfortable about it. If you have a handicap, always let them know that you know that they're looking at it. And so, look, let that get between us. Take the air out of it. And also cut the distance between you and the other person. But I can't give advice. But politically, if you've done something wrong or you've got a shortcoming, like you're an outsider or you're a newcomer, say it first.
Right.
It works better.
We're talking to Chris Matthews. He's the author of Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. You can join the conversation at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Brian, who is calling from Waltham. Hi, Brian.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call, Chris. I love your show.
Thanks, Brian.
I grew up idolizing Jack Kennedy in Massachusetts and questioned that recently when I read Rethinking Camelot. By Noam Chomsky, and I wonder what you think about his sense that JFK didn't push back on any of the national conventional wisdom of the time, especially regarding the Vietnam War and whether to escalate that situation.
Well, Kennedy, to the end, was a bit ambiguous in this sense. He told the crowd I'm going to go back to the records, you know, not speculation, but the records. The last speech he gave was in Fort Worth, and he basically said, if we pull out of Vietnam, that government there will fall tomorrow. But at the same time, he had all the advisors in there, and also at the same time, he made it clear that there'd be no American soldier involved in combat. And to the very end, he was threatening units. If any combat commander went into combat and broke the orders he had given, their unit was going to be in big trouble. And so he was very strict about that, and I have firsthand evidence of that. And so he also told people like Michael Forrestal, who was more dovish, he was on the National Security Council, to look at all options, including an exit strategy. He told people like Mike Mansfield, the Democratic leader of the Senate, and people like Kenny O'Donnell, he intended to get out after the 64 election. That strikes me as a bit cynical. All I can tell you is what he did with Laos, and that was to form a coalition government at Geneva and get us out of that fight. I think he would have tried to do the same with Vietnam eventually, paper over the fight between the Viet Cong and the government of the nationalist government of Diem, So I think he was really trying to get us out of that. And his whole history was against, I mean, nobody in his whole 3 years as president, he didn't send anybody into combat. So I don't know what Noam Chomsky's looking for in terms of evidence. When did he ever send combat troops into the field? He didn't. He spent his whole presidency, especially the last part, trying to avoid a nuclear confrontation by the nuclear test ban treaty, the peace speech at American University. He called it his finest accomplishment, cutting that deal with the Soviets. So I don't think he was a hawk at all.
Chris, let's talk about you mentioned how he spent a big chunk of his presidency trying to avoid nuclear war. Let's talk about that defining crisis in his presidency, the Cuban Missile Crisis. Here's President Kennedy addressing the nation after his administration discovers that the Soviets are installing what are essentially medium-range missiles on Cuba capable of hitting the U.S. with nuclear warheads. Let's listen.
Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
So, Chris, obviously, huge crisis of that time. Tell us what kind of pressure JFK was under to respond to those missiles more forcefully.
Well, he had the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the other members of the Joint Chiefs, like LeMay, Curtis LeMay, who had basically leveled Japan at the end of the war and basically ended the war even before we started to use the nuclear weapons. He had him calling for basically a strike on the missile bases. He had McGeorge Bundy, his national security advisor, calling for that. Admiral Shoup, another member of the Joint Chiefs. He had Richard Russell, his esteemed friend, Armed Services Chair. He had everybody, put Dean Acheson, the great Cold War veteran from the Truman administration, all saying strike. And Kennedy said his concern was that Khrushchev had warned him that if we struck Cuba, he would strike Berlin. And that was his first concern, because if the Soviets had moved on Berlin, they had 350,000 Red Army troops surrounding the city. On our side, we had 15,000 combined NATO forces. It would have taken an hour or two for them to get in there. And then Kennedy would have had to go to first use or else give up West Berlin, which would have been a horrendous message to our European allies if we gave up Berlin under pressure like that. So he was afraid of that chain reaction. He was a student of Barbara Tuchman and the Guns of August and how World War I began. He saw how these chain reactions work. We do this, they do that, then we do this, and then we're forced to do that. And so he tried to stop that chain reaction. It turns out, and he also was afraid of the fact that there were so many Soviets, troops and advisors on the island of Cuba. If we'd gone in there and hit the AAA fire, their anti-aircraft fire, and had basically begun an invasion, what the Joint Chiefs said we'd have to do as part of an attack on the bases, we'd be killing a lot of Russians. And he kept asking LeMay, or he asked him, well, what happened if we killed a bunch of Russians? And LeMay said nothing. Well, Kennedy didn't believe that, because he knew Khrushchev was under the same kind of pressure from his hawks that he was. That's why he went for the embargo. That's why, or the quarantine on missile ordnance coming in and materiel. And that's why he cut the secret deal with the Turkish bases, the Jupiter missiles, to pull them out secretly later on. Look, what we've learned since is that Khrushchev said in his memoirs that if we had attacked those bases, he had intermediate range missiles, not just medium range, and he could have hit New York. And he said in his memoirs, deliberatively, if I'd only had a couple of missiles left, I was going to hit New York. And I had big ones. I'd hit New York. And I wouldn't kill everybody in New York, but I'd kill millions of people and teach America what it's like to fight a war on its own territory. Now, that was immature, naive, because he must – how could he not have known that if he had struck New York from Cuba with nuclear missiles and killed millions of New Yorkers, that Kennedy would be forced to hit the Soviet Union in almost a first-strike kind of scenario? He'd have to go for it. And unleash all that we had. In fact, Kennedy promised to do that on television. He said, if you hit anywhere in North America with those Cuban-based missiles, we're going to hit the Soviet Union. So, I mean, this horror, this thing is so hard to talk about because it was so close. All we needed was a more of a hot hand president at the time, a Nixon or a Cheney or somebody like that, maybe a Newt. A little hotter head who said, wait, we're not going to take this.
Would have had
we're going to show them.
A very, very different outcome.
Chris, nobody thinks about it, but sometimes the most frightening thing in the world just walks right past you. And it's like standing on a street corner, all of a sudden the bus goes by and misses you by a foot, and you think how life would be different. I mean, you'd be dead. And so I think this is what the whole earth went through with that, just a foot from us this almost happened.
Well, related to this in the book, and this is sort of where you end close to the end, you write about the speech that he gave at the American University in June of 1963, the so-called peace speech. And we've got a brief clip. I want to just play it
it's
right
his
here.
Best speech.
Here we go.
As Americans, we find communism profoundly repugnant as a negation of personal freedom and dignity. But we can still hail the Russian people for their many achievements in science and space, in economic and industrial growth, in culture, in acts of courage. Among the many traits the peoples of our two countries have in common, none is stronger than our mutual abhorrence of war.
And Chris, he goes on to say, in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's future, and we are all mortal. Amazing words from the hard-nosed cold warrior at one point.
It was such an evolution on his part.
It really was, wasn't it? I'm wondering how that speech was received by the Soviets.
Well, they liked it so much that Khrushchev put it on Soviet television, which had never happened before. It was the first time, by the way, we in America had recognized the courage of the Great Patriotic War, the Russian fight against the invading Nazis in World War II, beginning in 1941. It was the first time we ever said, yeah, you guys are unbelievable what you were able to do with the Red Army against the Wehrmacht, what you pulled off. You defeated the enemy of the planet. And it was the first time we'd ever done that. It meant so much to the Russians to hear that from us. And I think Khrushchev, although a frightening figure in many ways, was a rational man. And that was what Kennedy had going for him. He didn't want to blow up the planet. He wanted to win the Cold War the way Kennedy wanted to win it, without a war. Mm. And so they had that in common. And I don't know what would have happened if Kennedy had survived Dallas, but I think the older I get, the more I think, boy, you know, he had the right goals. He was the one, you know, watch a football game in Ole Miss today or watch a football game with the Crimson Tide, Alabama. And there are some black players, and maybe mostly black players in some of the teams, but there were no blacks allowed to go to those schools. Where before Kennedy basically in 1962 and 63 said, it's over. No more Jim Crow, no more segregation. It's over. He was the guy that brought federal troops into Mississippi and opened up Ole Miss by force of arms. He did the same thing with Nick Katzenbach, basically forcing George Corley Wallace to step aside from the schoolhouse door. I mean, he did it. These things he did, you know, beginning the fight for civil rights in America as a president. First one to say it's as American as the Constitution, as fundamental as the Scriptures. He's the first one that did it. I mean, people that say he didn't get everything done. No, he didn't. But he began us on the course of winning the Cold War without war, which we ended up doing. And he thought he could do it through a technological display of our system being better, which is the space program. We could prove we are better than the Soviets by beating them to the moon. And I was in a Peace Corps at the time we went to the moon. And I remember one of my Peace Corps fellow volunteers took his people out onto a hillside and pointed to the light crossing the horizon. And he said, look at that. And he was teaching the people he was teaching, you know, this are my countrymen going to the moon. It's pretty impressive stuff.
Well, Chris, it's a great book. It's an impressive book. I want to thank you for coming in. It tells a great story about...
Anthony, thank you for being a great host.
About an interesting person. Would have been interesting to watch what would have happened had he lived a little longer. Chris Matthews, host of MSNBC's Hardball and NBC's The Chris Matthews Show. He's also author of Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. Thanks very much, Chris.
And happy holidays to you guys. Thank you.
Same
so much.
To you. You can read an excerpt from his book on our website, RadioBoston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, sports with Bill Littlefield. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.